KPFT, Houston.
Originating in Houston, Texas, devoted entirely to storytelling, right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM. I'm your host, Greg Audell, and I belong to a team saturated in talent. Doctors Hank Rubicek, Warren Holloman, Mary Edgerton, and stepping into her new role as our media representative and lead engineer is Tatiana Gago, and of course we have Floyd the Wonder Dog with us here as always. Together, we celebrate the power of story by placing the spotlight on tellers who take us on journeys through windows of their souls and transport us to magical worlds before returning us safely and gently back into the present. We've treated stories about justice on this program before, and they've always yielded some passionate images for listeners. Tonight's True Tales add to our stories about justice repertoire, with narratives that portray a distinctive take on what we term justice. My two guests are poised to convey the exact kind of stories that will simmer in our minds and our hearts for days to come, I suspect. David Jones is one of the most informed people about Houston's political past and present. He has co-hosted The Real Deal with Gary Polland, a show many consider the premier political program in Houston. David and Gary also co-host Red, White, and Blue on PBS for 13 years. It's sort of the definitive go-to place if you want to know what's going on in Houston and Harris County politics, as far as I am concerned. And Dr. Michael Schaefer is with us once again. He transfixed us in February of 2017 with his stories of empathy and soul, and we are so glad to have him back with us tonight. Welcome, both of you two. So what's your story?
How will I know whether I am on or not?
You are on.
Oh, really?
Yes, you are on.
That's I never heard a word you said.
Oh, let me see here. Let me adjust this. We'll get you on.
Yeah.
Is that any better? Am I in your ear?
No, you're in my head.
Oh, that's I think I've been in your head for a long time.
As long as you're telling me it's live, I'm happy.
We are live and on air.
Yeah.
And
I don't hear anything through the headphones.
There we go.
All right. Can y'all hear now?
There we go.
All right.
There we go.
Well, so, David, let's start with you. You've been involved with the criminal justice system for a while, both as a former assistant district attorney and assistant attorney general of Texas. No doubt you have several stories for every single political race and travesty in Houston dating back a few decades. Would that be fair to say?
To Kathy Whitmire, yeah.
To Kathy Whitmire. Wow. Yeah, that's about really where my political memory goes back in Houston. Jim McCann was just sort of another era to me.
Yeah, he was somebody that the Whitmire folks knew could be taken out, and who was the reason why she got in the race was that he was so weak, and it turned out to be the right decision.
I was going to say, apparently she was right.
Yeah.
You served on the executive board of the Houston branch of the NAACP for 2 years, and we're the nominee of the Democratic Party for Harris County District Attorney in 1984. Wow, what a different city we'd be.
Yeah, you know, that was my hope. There was that the the Democrats had slaughtered the Republicans in 82 because there was a Reagan recession. And I thought that it was possible that it could carry into 1984 because these local races such as DA are really down ballot lever pulling, if you will, kind of victories or losses.
But I guess that was Reagan's re-election. 84.
Yeah. Not only was it his reelection, it was the first time that Phil Gramm ran for the U.S. Senate after having changed parties.
Wow, wow. That is going back a little bit.
I had Johnny Holmes, and he was... So it was a lost cause.
I got to say, he had much better facial hair than you. he had you there. Your first story is a great way to start because it reminds me of Mahatma Gandhi's insight about the connection between justice and the human experience. When he said, "Justice will not be served until those who are unaffected are as outraged as those who are." And you are outraged because your story is about the death penalty case you fielded and one that challenged your faith in the criminal justice system. Would you tell us your story?
That's exactly right. I was appointed to represent a capital accused. I was not appointed as the number one lawyer for the job, but the number two lawyer. And I assumed that because of the judge who was a friend of mine, that he appointed that lawyer because that lawyer was experienced in death penalty work and would do the job. And it took me a few months, and then I found out that he was not paying attention. He was not doing the job of a lawyer in terms of finding out what was going on. I mean, what should be done to defend this guy who did something horrible, which I still can't get out of my head because I saw the pictures of the dead body, which is in part what led me to this position of being so vigorously against the death penalty was that. But so when I saw this lawyer do nothing, and then I knew, well, he's going to be found guilty. I better start doing my part because he obviously is failing. And I decided to put together the punishment case for this guy. And in so doing, I found a number of witnesses that would normally be used in a punishment case, including a former girlfriend and a Catholic priest came in and testified against the death penalty in a state court, which I thought was extraordinary. I really never thought that anybody would let him get away with that, but it happened. And I remember bringing to the final argument, you'll love this, the book Resistance, Rebellion, and Death by Albert Camus.
Oh, wow.
And he's got he has an essay against the death penalty in that book. And I read portions of it in the final argument. And I would have been really okay with the client having done so had it not been for the fact that during the course of the trial, he told me that when the one witness that survived the shooting that he engaged was going to be on the stand, who was the wife of the young man that he killed, that if I asked, and I was sitting right next to him in the courtroom, if I asked her one question, he would break my neck.
Wow.
Right, and he was big enough to do it. He said, "I will break your neck right here if she gets asked one question. Leave her alone." And so I said, "Your Honor, may we have a break?"
Wow.
Yeah. So, as it turned out, you know, the other lawyer who was doing the examination of this widow didn't ask any questions. It upset my guy, and I was not murdered in the courtroom. But I gave him the book, Resistance, Rebellion, and Death. And the Chronicle reporter who was covering this trial, because it had been moved from the regular courthouse to the Court of Appeals, which has a, you know, a bigger venue and more attractive for a reporter to be in than the mess at the courthouse, which at that time there was not a new courthouse. And this reporter saw my client carrying, because my client was so amazed at the words in the essay about against the death penalty by Camus that he just walked around carrying it proudly. Oh. And so there was a picture in the Chronicle of this guy and a write-up with him reading Resistance, Rebellion, and Death. As it turned out, He wanted death more than anything in the world. He wanted to die. He gave up all of his appeals. And the only other irony to this and the ending of this story is that his name was Beaver. And I could not get his mother to agree to come to the trial and be a witness on his behalf. And perhaps for good reason, because she'd put him in reform school and he'd been drinking cologne. You know, he had beer in the bottle whenever he was a baby. I mean, he was just addicted through and through. You know, by the time he got to this young couple's apartment and did the damage that he did. But when I drove through Virginia one year, not too long after that, there was a billboard that said, Beaver for Sheriff. And it was his brother.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. So it was like, this is the family's shame, and we're not going to be touched by it because we're running for sheriff, you know? Isn't that amazing?
You can't make that up.
No. So what the whole thing resolved for me was that the judge did not care that this lawyer was not doing his job. He was no pressure was ever put on him to do anything at all. All he did was turn in a voucher to get paid. And it ended up being that I don't know whether you've heard of the Penry case, where it says that, you know, any mitigating evidence, any at all, should be admitted into evidence, and there should be no scrutinizing of it and or objections to it if it's relevant to character. And so there was a case that had been reversed called Penry, where the district attorneys had objected to such testimony, and it became unconstitutional to do so. And this was the first case that was tried in Harris County where the judge was told, you have to let all this in. And the DA was so smart, he said, whatever you want to do, you know, put it all in. Juvenile records from Virginia, the Catholic priest, everything came in. So it was really constitutionally well done, in a sense. And I don't know that this other lawyer could have done anything with, you know, this poor woman who had been shot and left for dead than what he did. I don't know. I can't say. All I know is that my experience with it was that I was left alone to figure out how to save this guy's life. And I threw everything into it that I could, including resistance, rebellion, and death.
Quite literally.
Yeah, exactly. And it was, I've never taken a death penalty case since. I've never taken an appointment to one since, and never would take another one. It really solidified my convictions about how it was a horrible thing to be doing to somebody in a justice system that was so flawed as what I was a part of.
What year was this?
This would have been probably 85, 86.
Wow.
Something like that.
Wow. There are almost too many lessons to absorb in this story, but what is the single most important lesson you'd like the audience to take away from it?
Attend whenever you're asked to be a juror, do so, you know, because you could be the difference between life and death. That's important to take away. The other takeaway is that lawyers who we think are entrusted to do the job of doing justice are not necessarily doing anything other than paying the bills.
It's no less serious than a surgeon being paid to do surgery and just sleeping through the surgery, in my mind.
Right, right. You know?
Michael, what are your thoughts as you listen to David's story? What are your impressions?
Oh, this is really complicated. First of all, I thought it was wonderfully told, and it was just it was kind of frightening to listen to, of how many mistakes could be made, and nobody really paying attention. and a person's life is at stake. And maybe that person was at fault or maybe not, but the fact that this could be treated so cavalierly and whatever the outcome was somewhat almost predictable from the start because it was not very important to enough people.
Particularly in Texas in 1985.
Yeah. And from a non-Texan defendant and with no friends and no supporters other than what I could, gather up in the last weeks before the trial.
Tatiana, what are your thoughts as you listen to this story?
I mean, it's such a heavy story, but it's so good. But I guess from what I've heard from this story, he couldn't be saved, really, since you said he wanted to. He's been drinking like cologne.
But he certainly had the right to have someone try.
Exactly.
Yeah, I said as a child, he was given beer in the bottle, and he had been to various reform schools where they couldn't keep him from drinking cologne. He was constantly drinking something to be high at 8 years old. And I got all those juvenile records and put them into evidence, and I said, you're essentially dealing with a child.
But I wonder what kind of pain he was going through just to... in doing that just to get away from it. What kind of pain did an 8-year-old have?
I guess abandonment was what he was dealing with. I'm not sure. In the case, he had injected, and I don't know all the terms for these things, something ball, 8-ball. Right? You know what an 8-ball is?
I think it's cocaine and heroin.
And he'd also drank 24 beers before he ended up in the apartment of this couple.
And that's so true of many death row inmates. And it's not to justify anything that they've done, but it is to say maybe if we started treatment programs earlier and took it seriously, we'd avoid these people sort of being destined to go down this road, because without money, without insurance, there's really not a lot of options for them. David, as a powerful addendum to your story is one told by Nicole Caceres, a journalism professor at the University of St. Thomas and a lawyer for Anthony Graves. The story of his exoneration was told on this program on June 30th, 2016. And I'm hoping Hank is in the control room. I'm going to ask him to chime in because he hosted her on this program. Hank, if you're there, can you give us a little background before we listen to one of her stories?
I would be happy to, Greg. Thanks. Yeah, Nikki Caceres was a pretty remarkable guest. Actually, my wife knew her because she gave Nikki flute lessons.
Oh, wow.
Believe it or not, yeah, I know the life gets stranger than fiction all the time. But Nikki was really amazing. Her first story centered on the judicial idiosyncrasies and then about the exoneration itself. But the story that we're about to hear, I think, is amazing for this reason, because, she and her students, catch this, Tatiana, listen to this, all right? These are undergraduate students. Her undergraduate students, it was a project to exonerate Anthony Graves. And the research that they uncovered was really pretty unfathomable, pretty amazing what they did. And it was a group of students. And I just want to make that very clear. Also, KPFT was critical because Nikki wanted to communicate to Anthony about his freedom that was coming up on a Monday, but didn't want him to sift through the weekend without knowing this. So KPFT made it possible for her to broadcast his will-be freedom on the Friday before he was exonerated. It was pretty remarkable, so that he wouldn't have to wait over the weekend.
Isn't that amazing?
It is amazing, and amazing is the only word you can really use because it's right one out. Amazing thing it, after another.
It's right out of Aaron Sorkin.
It is. It is that's absolutely right. But it is students that helped her free Anthony Graves. This is that story. Tatiana, thank you. Might take just a moment.
All All right. Tatiana, are you going to need a minute? Because we can move to our next story.
I'm having some technical difficulties right here, Greg. One moment.
I'll tell you what. What we can do is we can just go back to this in a minute.
Guard able to recognize.
It just came on.
Jail guard, who said he heard Anthony say something incriminating over the jail intercom system. This testimony was problematic for a number of reasons. For one, we learned that the jail intercom was very unreliable. It rarely worked. For another, this jail guard had never met Anthony or heard Anthony's voice. Now, when you're listening to an intercom in another room, you can't see who is speaking. How was the guard able to recognize Anthony's voice if he had never heard Anthony speak? The guard testified that another guard, I'll call him guard number two, was also present and heard the incriminating statements. And guard number two had met Anthony, had heard his voice, and had identified the intercom speaker as Anthony. But guard number two never testified at Anthony's trial. I wondered why not. Why had the district attorney called guard number one but not guard number two as a witness? Guard number two's testimony would have been stronger. He would have been a better witness. It took me years to find guard number two, even though I thought I had his name. It turned out that he went by his middle name, and to find him, I had to learn his real first name. Then he had an unlisted phone number, and the only address I could find was a post office box. But ultimately, after years of searching, I made friends with one of his friends who agreed to arrange a meeting. So guard number two agreed to meet me at a fast food restaurant outside of Caldwell, Texas. I was incredibly nervous on my 2.5-hour drive to the restaurant. Would guard number two tell me what I thought was the truth? That the incriminating statement was fabricated. It had never happened. Or would he confirm guard number one's testimony and say that he heard Anthony's voice through the intercom? If so, my investigation would end up hurting my client's case. And it didn't help my nervousness when a few minutes after I arrived at the restaurant, four law enforcement officers walked in and sat down nearby. I didn't think that was coincidental. I often suspected I was being followed as I drove around interviewing potential witnesses. Guard number two arrived. He approached me. He sat down at my table. He was a big man, very Texan, kind of quiet. He confirmed he had been a jailhouse guard in 1992 and that he remembered Anthony Graves and Robert Carter being in the jail. I asked him, "Did you overhear Anthony making incriminating statements over the jailhouse intercom?" He said no. He said the only thing he ever heard Anthony say was that he was innocent and had been wrongly accused. Well, I said, "Well, did you identify Anthony's voice to guard number one?" He said, "No, that never happened. It never happened." Guard number two wrote out a statement for me at that fast food restaurant, and we went to a local bank where he signed it in front of a notary. The last thing I asked him was why he had never come forward with this information back in 1992. He told me no one had ever asked him to. Yet again, we learned that Anthony's conviction had been based on lies.
I know you've told these stories before many times, but I want you to know how much I appreciate you telling them again, because those who haven't heard them need to, and those who have need to hear them again.
You know, I don't think I've ever told that story before.
Is that right?
Yeah, I don't think that's one that I've never shared. So
Greg, yeah, and this is really a banter between the two of us, and I just wanted to sort of synthesize this part. And, you know, what Nikki is doing is very obvious, but she's talking about the kind of inconsistencies. And David, I know you can relate to this. When she said to me during that show, she said, you know, the greatest tool that we have as lawyers, as trial lawyers, is instinct, is intuition. She described it as sort of a non-rational knowing, a subjective computer, where you associate things from the time that you're born, you know when things are right, and you just know when things are wrong. And that makes a lot of good sense to me, and I know that it does to a lot of lawyers, and it certainly did to her. But it was her instinct that served as a catalyst for uncovering what was needed to be uncovered in order to get him free. And it was a remarkable story. And frankly, when you listen to her tell the story so meticulously, watching her in her body language as she was telling the story was even more probing, even more disclosing. She was closing her eyes every few seconds because she was thinking very clearly, very meticulously about sequencing the order of what she wanted to say. I just wanted to share that because I thought it was very insightful.
No, thank you. I'm so glad you did, Hank. It's certainly a powerful story, not only the way it's told, but the event itself. You know, one thing that concerns me about this story is, you know, my mom was a reporter, and so I've always had the feeling that reporters view their search for truth more seriously at times than law enforcement has historically, particularly in death penalty cases. And that's a feeling that's very difficult for me to shake. What are your thoughts on this, David?
Well, I think that there is a system of justice here that is predisposed, depending upon who's seen to be running it. And in the 80s and mid-90s, it was Johnny Holmes. And as I recall, being an assistant DA at the time that he was in office, there were two things that we were instructed on that I remember. One was to never let a black be on a jury. Never, never let it happen.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. And the other thing was that everybody said, you know, if you can convict an innocent person, you've got some skills. This was a true representation of the win at all cost feature of the criminal justice system in the 80s and 90s.
Which this is an ancient history, folks. This is our lifetime.
No. Even if they're innocent, if you can convict him, wow, you have done a job.
I'd love to think that was a rare exception. Michael, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I was struck by this, as the story was unfolding, of what tremendous courage this young woman had to follow her instincts and her determination to search out the truth for this young man. And it kind of makes me think that when you believe in something that strongly and you're committed to it, it gives you such strength and courage to follow through with your convictions.
That's true.
Where you might otherwise have turned away in the face of these somewhat overwhelming odds. But
it's very different than trying to meet a production deadline.
Yeah. And I'm reminded of prospectively what we may get into, which was when I believed fervently in the candidacy of one Jimmy Carter and was led down the garden path to disaster.
That will be a story for another day that I would like to hear very much. This is Greg Audell with Tatiana Gago on the boards, and you are listening to guest storytellers David Jones and Michael Schaefer tell stories about justice and fairness and maybe the flip side of that coin as well on So What's Your Story? Only on KPFT 90.1 Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 for all of our friends in Huntsville, Texas. When it comes to fairness, Tatiana will always provide the whole scoop and nothing but the scoop about Houston storytelling. Isn't that right, Tatiana?
Yes, it is, and I love how you're saying my name now.
It was only that first episode where I think I pronounced it five different ways, none of which were right.
Tanya, oh, I've had many nicknames. All right. Well, the best place to start is with our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild. They meet the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at Temple Emanuel, located on 1500 Sunset. Be sure to visit the Guild's website at www.houstonstorytellers.org for upcoming events like Skyline Screamers and a workshop given by Dr. Michael Winters and Dr. Hank on September 22nd. Be sure to check out all of our past So What's Your Story programs, every show since 2008 listed on the menu under Radio Program, which now exceeds a whopping 400 and cited as one of the best story inventories around. Everyone should join our friends at The Moth the second Tuesday of the month at Warehouse Live. The next one is September 12th, and the theme will be education. Dr. Hank will probably has too many stories to tell, but it's an event more fun than the law allows. Also, we want our listeners to stay addicted to So What's Your Story? And to know that not having a radio is not an excuse for missing our program, because you can listen to us stream live on kpft.org and Facebook Live. Don't forget to visit our page on our Facebook page, and to share our page with friends, families, lovers, and your enemies. And we'd love it if you like us when you leave. Did I cover everything?
You did. Please like us when you leave. That is the most important thing, my friends. And because of the hard work of Tatiana and Nicole and our co-host, but most importantly, our audience, you know, our Facebook page, our Instagram page, you know, we just get more and more feedback every week. And that's how we find more storytellers that we wouldn't know about unless you tell us that you've got a great story or you've got someone else you'd like to be a storyteller on the program. And by the way, Tatiana, I was very, very proud of your very first episode hosting So What's Your Story? That was fantastic. That was, what, 2 weeks ago?
Yes, and it was so fun. Thank you.
It is fun, isn't it?
Yeah, and really nice being on the other side. It's really different.
Yeah. Well, I was really proud of the job you did, and I know I speak for all of our hosts and our audience when I say that. It was pretty impressive, and I look forward to having you back in the host chair very, very soon. Now, Michael, you were born in Norton, Kansas, and have been exploring the world ever since. These travels led in part to your work with us. Was it Surgical Volunteers?
Yes, that's correct.
And I believe you practiced pediatric plastic surgery in Chicago for about 30 years. And Chicago's loss was Houston's gain when you retired to Houston. You've become a dear friend not only to me, but to this program. And for regular listeners of this program, I have to throw in that one day Michael was telling me about his wonderful house that his father-in-law had designed in 1955 by one Harwood Taylor, the uncle of one of our favorite storytellers, Harwood Taylor. That is just amazing to me.
Isn't it? Yeah.
It is.
I was thrilled to meet him tonight.
Yeah, when you told me Harwood Taylor, I was like, man, is Harwood like 95 and just looking really, really good?
He's had a lot of plastic surgery.
A lot of plastic surgery. My impression is that not only, just from our conversations, that not only was your practice laced with ethos and respect for patients, but filled with empathy and care for the many, many, many children you took care of. A not common enough description of many professionals I found. Most interesting is how your sense of fairness and ultimately a sense of justice that speaks to this. Will you share your story with us?
Greg, I'd love to. It's my take on this fairness and justice theme is a little bit different, but I hope the underlying relationship will come through. Not all prison sentences are man-made. In fact, there are such sentences created or handed down by Mother Nature or genetic mistakes, or, depending on one's belief, the hand of a greater power. My life's work was taking care of children with birth defects, mostly of the head and face. It's been said that your face is your calling card to the world. Just imagine if your face is crooked or deformed or just abnormal in some way. That person may very well be trapped by their appearance and condemned to a life of shame and feelings of worthlessness, much like an inmate in a federal prison might feel. My story tonight is about a remarkable young man who overcame his life sentence of a serious deformity of the face and ears and is now a successful young businessman and a world-class athlete. Gregory was born with a condition called Treacher-Collins syndrome, a genetic birth defect in which the facial bones are deformed, including absent cheekbones, and a retrusion of the lower jaw to the point that the airway is obstructed, often fatally, and absent or severely deformed external ears. So it's really quite a remarkable facial deformity. This child was referred to me shortly after birth, and we began life-saving measures to ensure the safety of the airway, and then made plans for the surgical correction of his facial deformities and those of his ears as well. Over the next several years, this boy underwent countless operations to correct his deformities. These included multiple bone grafts to the face, that is, taking bone from another part of the body to be used to construct some of the missing bones of the face. In his case, this involved taking one or more ribs and using them to develop cheekbones and to correct the defects around the eye sockets. We also did multiple surgeries for the creation of external ears, using cartilage from his rib cage. This was an attempt to give him the appearance of normal ears, although his hearing was permanently impaired and hearing aids were unavoidable. Over the years, and after many surgeries, this boy came to look reasonably acceptable. Though not normal, he was no longer severely deformed. He grew up into a remarkable young man, and herein lies the crux of my story tonight. Gregory found me again after some years of being out of contact. He is now married and lives in Dallas. We met 3 years ago on the occasion of a family wedding taking place there. He was then 36 years old and a successful young businessman, a regional manager for an insurance company. I asked him how he was getting along, especially in light of his facial limitations. That is, did he feel good about himself? Did he have the confidence it takes to get up each morning to face the world and all its challenges? He said, "Dr. Schaefer, I just decided a long time ago not to let this get me down. I decided to make the most of what God gave me, and you helped me to deal with. Your surgeries gave me the self-confidence to grow up and be the man I thought I should be." I asked him what he meant by that, and he told me that his job requires him to travel and meet with people all over his territory. He often calls back for a follow-up on his previous visit. He then grinned and says, "You know, they almost all remember me. If not for what we talked about, it's for the way I look. And I decided to use my special gift of a kind of unique appearance to enhance my calling card. That is, my face helps me be remembered, and then I do the rest on my own ability." Greg finished the story of his life by telling me how he had also decided not to be the kind of skinny runt he had started out to be. At about age 30, he committed to becoming a triathlete. That is, to train and participate in the Ironman competition. Yes, the main one in Hawaii. Although he could not swim a stroke, he took lessons and he trained and he trained. And then he got into open waters and he became really good. The other parts came more easily to him, that is, the running and the cycling. When we last talked, he had competed in 3 Ironman contests in Hawaii and had run and completed 3 marathon races, each with commendable times. One can indeed free oneself from the prison sentences of physical abnormalities and disfigurements and be free to be one's complete and whole self. Such was this young man.
Wow, what an amazing story and an incredible young man.
Exactly. You know, that is, of course, it's told very well, too.
Of course.
Yeah.
We can always count on Michael for that.
Yeah, yeah. He's got a knack for this.
Thank you.
Well, yeah, actually, your voice reminds me of Cary Grant said President Kennedy would call him when he was stressed out and say, "Just talk." He just wanted to hear his voice. He said, "Your voice relaxes me." Michael has a voice like that. It's like, "Just talk."
If I could just toss in a little bit here. I, on more than one occasion, was doing a little operation under local anesthesia. And I'd say, "It'll be just a little stick now while we inject the local." And this one guy in particular said, "Oh, hell, doc, just talk to me. I'll fall asleep."
I would take that as a compliment, I think.
Yeah, right.
Well, do you keep up with this young man?
We do occasionally. It's not not often, but
I want to meet this guy sometime. He's like, I'm already in. Yeah. I've never
we'll invite
met him,
to come down sometime.
We need a picture. That's what we need.
Yeah, we need a picture and tell him he has a an invitation to be a guest on this show.
Oh, wouldn't that be sweet?
Yeah, I'd
yeah,
love
thank
to have
you.
The two of you on together. What do you want us to remember from this story, Michael?
The moral of my story is to accept the fate life has given you. To be gracious and grateful for what you have, and find ways to use those gifts to your advantage, or conversely, to use one's disadvantages as a springboard to into bigger and better things, like deciding to reach beyond the easily obtained rewards and thus be able to be proud of who you are and what you've accomplished.
I mean, if this guy had just gone down the road of being angry and resentful of his situation, imagine the crummy life he would have had.
It was purely a choice he made. He could have spent his life feeling sorry for himself.
No, he met a doctor who made the difference in his life. You know, I am so tired of hearing people say, you know, after a doctor has done some amazing job of repairing this and saving a life and whatever, and I hope this is not inappropriate, but to hear people say, God was with us, you know. No, you had a great doctor, number one.
Thank you.
Yeah. And that's...
I was just channeling from above. I just happened to be the instrument of somebody else.
That's true. I'll accept that.
Thank you. I loved taking care of this boy. He was a particular star in my patient population because he never complained. He was always very eager to do the next step to make him better. And he had the best parents who supported him for that, too.
I have to step in because I love what you're saying. You know, God is there to urge us on, and that's it. You have a great doctor, and that's the truth. You have a great doctor. You have great teachers. You have great lawyers. You have great plumbers. It's not God.
Come on, give us all a little reward. You know,
a little bit. And don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying God doesn't exist. I'm saying that, you know, God helps, but God doesn't do it.
Well, we also need to help God carry out the work that he might have.
That's right.
No, I think that's very true. And I think I come down on it to say that we're just not at a point of understanding of what God does or doesn't do.
Right.
But I would certainly never take away the credit from the surgeon or the lawyer or the baker or the teacher.
All I know is that if God is doing it, if God is doing it, then I just don't have to pay the doctor. That's all I'm telling you right now. So, enough said. I've interrupted. Sorry. Had to get that out.
You're always welcome, Hank.
Thank you, Hank.
And, you know, one thing that I find so fascinating about your career, Michael, is you've often known your patients from the time that they were teeny tiny children all the way through adulthood. And
absolutely.
I don't think many doctors have that in their career.
It was such a privilege. For many of these children, I operated on them 15 or 20 or 30 times because much of what we did was required a stepwise process to build on something that had been done previously. And so it was, it did require this nearly lifelong relationship with some of these kids.
Well, and friends, if you haven't had a chance to hear Michael's previous story with us when he was on in February of 2017, I urge you to go to HoustonStorytellers.org and pull up that story. It's one of the more moving that I've heard about his relationship with a young patient and their friendship through her adulthood, and it is very well worth your time. Now, David, I don't know if you'll remember this or not, though I referenced it earlier this evening, but the first time I met you many years ago, I don't even remember why I was in your office, but I walked in and you had pictures of Democratic presidents on your wall, and I was so impressed, and I took a close look at them, and then I told you how much I appreciated you putting my picture on your wall before I came in. You looked extremely confused until I pointed to the photo of President Clinton in front of Houston City Hall. And peeking just over his shoulder was my face, and it was from the Houston Chronicle. Do you remember that at all?
I remember you coming in and not paying your bill.
Well, that's not a unique memory.
Right.
I paid for the service I received.
Exactly. Now, this was a picture on my wall of
Didn't you have Democratic presidents?
Sure.
Yeah, on your wall. And
sure.
One of the pictures you had was from when he was in Houston. It was from the Houston Chronicle. They got the shot. But it was during the campaign. So it was a lot easier to get close to him at the time. That was a fun campaign to be involved in. I was a volunteer, and we got to go running with him, got to have coffee with him in the mornings, and you just stare at this guy and you think, wow, he's got a really good shot of being President of the United States.
And yeah, you know what? And I was given the choice early on. Bill Clinton, he's going to be the guy. And I was thinking, I'm waiting for Mario Cuomo to get in his get in his plane and fly to New Hampshire. I literally was waiting for that to happen.
A lot of us were expecting that to happen. I think that'll be one of the mysteries that maybe we'll know, and maybe we won't, as to why he didn't get involved in that race.
And why did he turn down the Supreme Court?
I think whatever it is.
He could have been on the Supreme Court.
Whatever it is, it's the same answer, I think. And maybe we'll know, maybe we'll never know.
It's called...
Maybe Chris Cuomo will eventually tell us.
Yeah, right. That's right.
Now, David, you've spent thousands upon thousands of hours on Houston airwaves. Do you use storytelling in your work?
Well, I do my best to draw out, in the limited time that we have on PBS of 23 minutes, the ideas that people hold. I wouldn't really call it storytelling in the sense that what I've heard tonight. It could end up telling a story about how politics works Houston and in the state of Texas. Yeah,
I'll tell you, certain politicians have their stories down. The one thing I know about John Edwards is that his dad was a factory worker.
That's true.
I must have heard that several hundred times during that campaign. I don't remember much else of what he said, but I know his dad's a factory worker.
Well, remember, he also was talking about the rich and the poor. He made a pretty good argument. He was just...
I was on the John Edwards bandwagon, trust me.
Yeah, I never was. Well, I just thought he was too pretty, so I thought nobody's going to elect him.
I actually got invited to a meeting. Richard Midhoff, an attorney, invited me to a meeting with John Edwards one time, and I thought it was going to be a large meeting with a lot of people there. I didn't realize until Mr. Midhoff and John Edwards walked in that it was just three of us. And Mr. Midhoff said, John, Greg's someone you really need to get to know. And I remember thinking, no, he really, really doesn't. And I think John Edwards actually figured that out after about 30 seconds. It was a very brief meeting. But I was a little horrified to find myself there. Now, David, you and I have both done our time in the politics of Beaumont, Texas, which are a lot of stories can stem from that. I need to be careful with the term doing time, but I think our listeners know what I mean. Before I say any more, would you tell us your story about Beaumont, Texas?
Yes, I was running the campaign for Jimmy Carter for re-election in 1980 and had six counties, among which were Jefferson and Orange, Galveston, Brazoria, and the like. So Jimmy Carter wanted to come to Port Arthur, Beaumont for a port event. It was just a political deal. And I was in charge of the event itself, me and the Secret Service types who plan these things. We were all in it together as far as who does what and how many buses do you need and who's going to be riding where and things like that. And this is when I learned about how ugly and how perfect sometimes politics can be, right? I was told to put six people in the car to ride with Jimmy Carter from the airport to the event, and I was told to reward whoever I wanted to. I picked a guy named Lloyd Hayes, who was the mayor of Port Arthur and had donated the campaign headquarters, to be one of the six. I did not pick Jack Brooks, who was the congressman from that area.
Uh-oh.
Right, right. So, and I had my run-ins with Brooks because he thought he could run everything, and he was way behind the times. He's running against Ronald Reagan. It's 1980, and he doesn't even get to town until October, and everybody in all of these counties were sitting around waiting for Jack Brooks to show up and tell him what to do. They weren't listening to me. So, and we know what happened. But anyway, so... As Air Force One is landing, I mean, literally it's above my head coming in for landing, the Secret Service guy comes up to me and says, David, you're going to have to make room on your from one of your six has got to go. Jack Brooks has now found out that you did not put him in a car with the president.
I'm surprised you're still living.
So I had to go to this very nice man, Lloyd Hayes, and tell him, because the rest of them were sort of grassroots people. And I knew this guy could handle it, and I had to go tell him. I said, hey, Lloyd, I don't know what to tell you, but Congressman Brooks would like to have your spot. And he said, don't worry, David, we know Jack Brooks, you know. So at the end of it, the event goes through. I am really unhappy, very mad. I didn't go down and watch the event. I stayed in a big van towards the end of the column of cars. And all of a sudden, I see this golf cart coming up towards me. And the guy driving the cart says, get in. You're going to meet the president. And Jack Brooks had set it up so that I could meet Jimmy Carter at Air Force One. It was his way of, you know, making up. And it was, it's sort of the, you know, it's
sort of classic Jack Brooks.
Yeah, but it's also classic, you know, political ups and downs, you know, yeah. they're always there.
Yeah, very much from the LBJ school.
Yeah, very much.
You know, I'll destroy you and then send you flowers in the morning.
Yeah, and he couldn't have been nicer to me. He introduced me to Jimmy Carter as if I was his best friend and was going to pull out the county for him and blah, blah, blah.
When I was working in Beaumont, I was in charge. We had this event where Harry Truman's train came to town, and it was a nice high-dollar event. And I was, Jack Brooks was coming, and I was looking forward to introducing him to
my. This was 1948.
No, this. Oh, yeah, it was. It is his train, but yeah, whoever owns it sends it all over for campaign events.
Oh.
But this would have been 1998, I think. But so I was going to introduce the former congressman to my staff. He comes in with his lovely wife and a guest with the loudest string of expletives because he didn't like where we had put campaign signs out for the event. And he just screamed and cursed at us for about 5 minutes while his lovely wife and guest just stood there and smiled and nodded their head. It was surreal, though. I just couldn't believe this was the first way we were meeting, you know, the former congressman.
Former congressman.
At the time, yeah, Nick had already, this Nick had been in one term at this point.
Nick Lampson.
Nick Lampson, yes. And Nick Lampson, who I think is running for county judge in Beaumont, if I'm not mistaken, right now.
One of the best office holders there could be is that guy.
Well, the only one thing I will say I was proud of him, he started the Congressional Caucus on Missing and Exploited Children, which was long overdue. So, Dave, what did you learn from your campaign experience that in this story?
Well,
that you can tell us on the air.
Yeah, right. It was a heartbreaking kind of event for me because I was so desperately hoping that Carter would pull it out. I knew it was up against the wall and the like. And I put a whole lot of effort into trying to get all of these people in these six counties alive and persuaded to believe that Carter could do it. And of course, running up against the likes of Jack Brooks, who basically had it all under control and nothing was going to happen until October,
right,
no matter what
right.
I said. So
right.
I think the lesson I learned about it was that, you know, you have to be careful about putting too much on the line in politics because you can really be hurt.
It will burn you up. I'm very happy to be involved in politics now as an active volunteer as opposed to a staff member. It's a very tough life. You know, you don't realize that a staff position on campaign is 24/7 and you get beat up from all sides.
Right. And, you know, the other thing that I noticed about that area of the state was when I took two of our activists who were working in the campaign, both black females, and I took them into a Port Arthur seafood restaurant. And it was just the three of us walking in the door. And I looked around and everybody was staring at us. And I said to my black friends, I said, what is going on? I mean, they said, David, no white guy goes in here with black females, you know?
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, and this was 1980. Again, mm-hmm. not as long ago as one would think.
Yeah.
It's when I was on the campaign, there was a young man, I believe he had just gotten out of the military, who was on our team, and we were driving through Lumberton, and I went in to get a soda. He says, "I'm staying in the car." He goes, "I'm not getting out of my car in Lumberton, Texas." And again, this was in 1998, you know, and it was just shocking because that had never been part of my reality. That was part of the history books, you know, and I didn't realize that was still an issue. And again, it just showed my ignorance more than anything else. You know, one thing we love to ask our storytellers is sort of the roots of their storytelling and who was the storytelling in their home. So, Michael, in your family, who was the storyteller?
Well, I knew you were going to ask this, partly because I read the script and I know what you ask, and I was kind of dreading it. I didn't come from a family of storytellers, but I did come from a family in which letter writing was elevated to a fine art. And some of my fondest memories from my childhood come from sitting around on a weekend afternoon, usually a Sunday afternoon, and mostly at one or the other grandparent's home, and out would come the letters that had been written during the preceding week or two or a month, and they'd be read. Somebody would read them.
That is certainly a form of storytelling.
It is, but it's kind of the written form, but it's not somebody just sitting around spinning a yarn.
Yeah.
But it was kind of a way of communicating from one part of the country to another. Aunt Etheldred had just done this and had sent a note to Uncle John, and so usually somebody was designated to read that letter, and it'd be full of news, and it was just a wonderful way of, and then from there memories developed and stories then ensued, because not infrequently one would say, "Do you remember what that letter said, or what somebody said in that letter?" And that became the focus of a story.
Mine was easier than that. I was surrounded by storytellers.
That does not surprise me.
I had uncles that told stories, and everybody was just sitting there waiting for the punchline. And
as we do with you.
My old man told stories. It was just every day was constant.
Well, thank you, David Jones and Michael Schaefer, for your meaningful journeys through the world of justice and fairness.
Welcome.
And injustice and unfairness. And in doing it with your signature styles, complete with the poignant reflections with which they come. Next week, Mary Edgerton will host a great slate of tellers who will be taking us traveling around the world without leaving the studio on So What's Your Story? Don't you dare move, because Vinyl Avenger and Wild Bill are up next with the cool classics for the cooler you. Make 90.1 a part of every day. And while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling out, join us each and every Wednesday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. You keep loving great stories, and we will keep bringing them to you. I'm Greg Audell, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it is never too late to live happily ever after. Peace, my friends.
Get even more from your KPFT listening experience by checking out our HD2 stream. New and improved, get acquainted with our revamped weekly schedule now at kpft.org. Fear not, nationally syndicated favorites like Democracy Now!, Ralph Nader Radio Hour, Letters in Politics, and Economic Update remain. And good news, our evening schedule now features more local shows, including a stellar mix of public affairs, music, comedy, and Spanish language programming created and produced right here at KPFT. Don't miss a second on HD2.